Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on our Facebook page, Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
And on Twitter, at Broadway Curtain, or Instagram, at Broadway Curtain Podcast.
We are going to be airing right now part three.
Trace
of our interview with the fantastic...
He was so good, we had to have him three times.
Leroy Reams. It also helps that he gave us martini after martini.
This is true.
And that helped a lot with this podcast.
So anyway, wow. We're on stage after David made the announcement. No one knew what to do.
Yeah.
And Jerry Orbach, God bless him, turned and said, bring in the curtain, bring in the curtain. So they brought the curtain in. And as the curtain hit the stage, I had a flashback to a conversation I had with Gower. Because we talked a lot. And he said, you know, during the 70s, Leroy, I thought my career was over. He said that no one wanted to see what I did anymore. And he said, and during that period, I went to the discos, I did the drugs. I wanted to try to get with it. And he said, I just woke up one day and said, why am I doing this? This is not me. I'm an old-fashioned song and dance man. And he said, and when David asked me to do the show, I understood it. And even though my doctor said I shouldn't, he said, I did because... I don't want to be remembered as a has-been. Oh. That's what went through my mind at that moment. Mm-hmm. It was like a light went off. So then, as we do, it's opening night.
Yeah,
we have an opening night
celebrate?
Party. We've got, you know, people there. We're going to the Waldorf Astoria for a sit-down dinner on opening night. Are you ready for that? The reason being, we only had one producer.
Right.
We had one producer.
Wow.
And, of course, there were, you know, celebrities and the company, and we had a sit-down dinner at the Waldorf Astoria with an orchestra.
Oh,
it was the classiest opening night ever in my life.
Wow.
It was perfection. So when we're all standing on stage, everybody were like robots. We all ran up to get dressed to go to the party.
Mm-hmm.
I walk into the party. Who's the first person I see? Bob Fosse. Who comes up to me and says, I remember it as if it were today, that son of a bitch. He said, that son of a bitch. He said, I filmed my own death, and he had to do me one better by doing it on fucking opening night.
Mm-mm.
And we laughed so hard. And I said, you know, Bobby, Gower, if he's up there, is laughing with us.
Mm-hmm.
I said, he would be so pleased that you said that. And so anyway, and we had our opening night party. It was incredible. I mean, we were all like zombies.
Mm-hmm.
We were trying to have a good time, but it was what it was. And of course, the press and everything were just going crazy. And it was interesting that the next day on the news, I was the person selected to go on Channel 4 with Pia Lindstrom
to
talk about it. I'll never understand that. I mean, there was Jerry and Tammy and people in the company and Wanda. But I was the one asked to go on the show and talk about it.
Yeah.
And I have a copy of that.
Oh,
it was
very
interesting.
Love to see that.
Well, because I felt so close to Gower. Yeah. And it was almost a joke that Gower didn't have to tell me what to do. Mm-hmm. I knew what he wanted.
Yeah.
It was like, we were just so tuned in that he would look at me and I knew exactly what he wanted me to do. And like in Dames, when he was putting it together, I said, oh, Leroy, I don't have time to choreograph. You know when you have to sing, when you find a hole, come through it and hold your hat and do your cane and make some poses.
That's brilliant.
But he didn't have to tell me. Yeah. I knew. And, when we laughed when he did Lullaby of Broadway, because he staged it with all of us. It was incredible how he did that. And it was perfect. And then he said, then we add the principals, and he had us all sing that opening thing. Come on along, at that point. Mm-hmm. And we all auditioned, me, Carol. And of course, everybody laughed because once I sang, they knew I was going to be it. So we did it, of course, and the thing about, let's call it up. And again, Jerry went, hit it. And that was done in rehearsal because Jerry couldn't hit the note. So he just pointed at me, and I hit the note, and I got a laugh, and Jerry said, leave it in.
Brilliant. So, amazing.
Then those things happen.
Yeah.
But it became a joke because, and I know that had Gower lived, seriously, had he lived, that I would have at least, if not been in his next show, I would have been one of his assistants.
Yeah.
Because it was just, our minds were Simpatico. Just in
yeah.
sync.
Yeah.
One of the most iconic images of 42nd Street is you in midair over a dime.
And I'll tell you how that happened. It was at the photo shoot, and Gower went to the bathroom, and I grabbed Martha Swope, and I said, I've got a great idea for a shot. I'm going to get on. I said, kids, come out here. Get around. Get in the lines. And I said, I'm going to go 1, 2, 3, jump in the air, Martha, and catch me. She said, I got you. And Gower was peeing in the bathroom.
No
So that's
way.
How we got that shot. Yeah. Yeah,
I love that.
I set that shot up.
I love that. Yeah.
And it's one of the, it's like the most iconic shot.
Totally.
Of the whole thing.
And I thought when they told me as a surprise, David was going to put me on Times Square in the middle there on that big billboard.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought that's the shot they would use. Instead, they did one where there were three of us doing a step, which was not as good. But anyway, but David was wonderful to me. And what's interesting, I should talk about money now, because this is David Merrick. David Merrick would set a pay scale, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
When we opened the show, 1980, Jerry Orbach and Tammy Grimes made $3,500 a week.
Wow.
The next level was Carol Cook and Joe Bova made $1,500 a week.
Mm-hmm.
I made $1,250.
Mm-hmm.
Wanda made $750. Wow. And David had her under a 2-year contract with a raise the second year.
Wow.
And when I found out that Carol Cook and Joe Bova made more money than I did. Mm-hmm. I had billing above them and worked harder in the show. I was fit to be tied to my agent. Said, there's nothing we can do.
Yeah, no. It's
and when the salary was offered, I wanted more money. And they said, Leroy, that's it. When David Merrick offers the money, that's it. Either you take it or leave it. You don't negotiate with David Merrick.
Yeah, no. It's...
So I said, okay, I'll talk to David. And one day at the theater, I said, David, I need to talk to you about something. I find it hard to believe that I work harder on the show and have billing above Carol and Joe, and they're making more money than I do. He said, well, we can arrange that. So would you like to sign on for a second year? I said, no, because I may not want to stay a second year. I said, but David, I signed the contract. I'll honor it. I love the show. It's going to be very good for me, and you won't have a problem with me, but I should be paid more money. And the next week, the raise was in my check. And
what?
He passed by the dress room and said, don't pay your agent. They don't deserve it. And I never really re-signed another contract with David. And he would give me periodic raises when he wanted to.
Fascinating.
But that was David Merrick.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
He had to be in charge.
Yeah, no kidding.
So, he was quite something. Wow. And, of course, when the thing with Karen Prunzik, she didn't leave the show. When they took away her number and they took her out of Dames because David said she wasn't pretty enough to be wearing the clothes. And Gower would not fire her. But then when Wanda got the Go Into Your Dance thing, which they did, then they had to put Karen back into Shove Off because Wanda didn't like doing the number.
Yeah.
So Karen eventually got put back, and then one of the girls quit. And so Karen had to be put back into Dames. So eventually, and of course, once Gower is dead now, David is escorting Wanda around. But Wanda didn't want to be put in an uncompromising position, and she and Karen were buddies and were living together at that point. So Wanda used to bring Karen along on the dates. And the first thing you know, Karen gets with David.
The woman he deemed too ugly.
That's right. When we were in New York, of course, we would see David's car come up. So I knew that that was Karen. And I told her, when I said, "Say hello to David for me," didn't I, Karen? She said, What do you mean? I said, "Oh, come on, Karen. We all know what's going on." So, and then of course, then she and Wanda had a little tiff, because when Wanda missed shows, David did dock her. And then Karen, of course, said, Wanda's not always sick. So, because she, had her. And then when Wanda did get sick, the girl who was the understudy, Nancy Sinclair, who was hired out of town by David Merrick, much to Gower's displeasure, but he couldn't do anything about it. And then when Wanda got sick, Nancy Sinclair was in California at a child custody battle with her ex-husband, and there was no one to go on. And Karen Prunzik said, "I'll go on. I know the part." And I went to David Merrick that night, and I said, "I'll tell you what, David, she does know it, because she's watched it. She's smart, and she's a hell of a dancer." Mm-hmm. And I said, "I'll go on stage with her tonight, because I think she could do it." Mm. And David didn't let her do it. And they tried to get Nancy back the next day, but they couldn't. Then they put Karen on. Yeah. And we had a rehearsal that afternoon, and Karen did go on and did the part for a couple performances. They got Nancy Sinclair back. And, of course, David was, playing up the publicity on that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, of course. Because,
he really got to go on and all that. And Nancy was kind of like a June Haver-looking girl, blonde and very pretty, and she was, good in the part. And so that was going on. And then she went back to California because the child custody, and David didn't want her to go. And he was very upset. And wait a minute, I got the story wrong. She actually did that. And then when she went back, he put Karen on. I got that confused. That's really what the truth is. I got confused.
That's right.
And so then David sued her, and she was taken out of Actors Equity for 6 months. And he did that to Nancy Sinclair.
Wow.
Yeah. And then Wanda was put back, of course, came back.
That's crazy.
Show.
That is crazy.
Yeah. And then Lisa Brown replaced Wanda. Uh-huh. But then when they did the Chicago company, David hired Nancy Sinclair after having fired her, and she was out of, Actors Equity for 6 months. And,
right.
All of that. She was taken to litigation. Yeah.
Holy Mary.
So that's how the show goes on. Of course, by this time, David was married to Karen Prunzik because they had had their little thing. And then Karen said, David, I can't have an affair any longer because she went back to Pittsburgh and left the show. And then David brought her back and married her. And they had gone to Hawaii on their honeymoon.
Yeah.
And Steve Bell, who was in the show, his mother lived in and saw him there. And he introduced Karen as his wife, and she called Steve, and that's how we found out. And the irony behind the whole thing, Wanda Rich and Karen, these two young girls, their first Broadway show and being tied up with two legends in the theater.
I mean, it was wild.
And then when they go to Chicago for the opening of the show, Karen goes there as Mrs. David Merrick and goes to rehearsal. And of course, they finally decide to let Karen do her old part for the opening, because what she really wanted to do was play the lead. Mm-hmm. But David didn't want her to. And so at the opening night party, of course, Nancy Sinclair is the toast of the town and being photographed, and Karen is there as Mrs. Merrick, and her name wasn't in the program by mistake because the other girl's name had been printed. So Karen's father got into a big argument, and David Merrick went back and said, "Fire her in the part and fire her as my wife," and left. This was in Chicago, so Karen went back to Pittsburgh. And then now we know that David and Karen are separated. Now, this gets very confusing, but this is the way it goes. So then, David, it's Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day.
I think it was Valentine's Day. Sometimes I get confused, but I think it was Valentine's Day. And David was going to throw a party for us at Elaine's. And we went to Elaine's, and David didn't show up. He had his stroke that night.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
It was in the hospital.
Oh.
So then, of course, Karen is called because she's still the legal wife. Weird. And David may die from the stroke.
Oh, my gosh.
So she came back to New York. And, of course, he can't speak and is going through all this stuff, And so then David didn't die, but he can't speak. But then what happened one day, he got money from one of the nurses, got in a wheelchair, wheeled himself out of the hospital. And it was like near Chinatown from what I was told, and went to a phone booth and called his lawyer and was going, and the phone, and the lawyer knew it was David, but couldn't understand him. And a cop came along and said, picked up the phone and said, this man's in a wheelchair, and I know who he is. He's David and Mary. They said, hold, and then they got enough out of David that he didn't want to be with Karen, and they took him to Eitan, his wife before Karen, to her apartment, and that's where he did his rehabilitation because he didn't want to be in the hospital. Then he started on the road back, but he never really, of course, fully recovered. What happened during that period, of course, we hadn't seen David, and on the weekends, sometimes I used to go over to Freddy's on the mm-hmm. east side and do my club act, mm-hmm. like a late show
yeah.
on the
yeah.
weekends. And Eitan, David's wife, because he's now separated from yeah. Karen, and the divorce is going to happen. Eitan said, David keeps seeing your picture in the paper and pointing to it, and we think he wants to come and see you because he's been very bad with his therapy, and the doctor said it's a good sign that he wants to go out. So she said, we're going to bring him to see your show, but don't have anybody photograph him because mm-hmm. he's got a cane and he can't talk and all this. And I said, well, I'll make sure that doesn't happen. So I told him at the club, I said, now when David and Mary comes, you know, don't anybody take pictures. And, you know, so anyway, they said, he's here the night that he came. So I went out to meet him. And of course he was going, oh, blah, 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 and of course couldn't understand a word he's saying. And I'm pretending I do. I said, thank you, David. Lovely to see you. And we start walking into the club and he starts leaning forward and pushing Eitan and me aside. And finally leans over, he found a penny on the floor. Picked it up, put in his pocket. And I looked at Eitan and I said, I think David's feeling better. And so he sees the show. And then afterward, I come down to sit with him and tears are streaming down his face. And he's patting my hand. And I shouldn't tell you, you may not want to put this on either, but I'm just telling stories. So as I sat down, he took a program out of his pocket from the show. And I said, were you at the show tonight, David? And Eitan said, yes, we brought him in for a little bit. We didn't stay long, but, you know, we brought him in for a little bit. And David opened up the program, and clear as a bell, he had circled the names. And I'm telling you what he said, you can't put this in, though.
Wow.
And when all of those contracts, when they ended, they weren't hired again.
Wow.
That came to fruition. Did the show almost 8 years. And the only reason I left it was to do La Cage aux Folles.
How long did you say?
Almost 8 years doing 42nd
Street. My God. And
wow.
You left to do La Cage?
Yeah,
on Broadway?
To do, yeah, yeah, to replace on Broadway. But what happened, I had another story to tell you along the way. Well, anyway, but that's how La Cage came into being. Because I had auditioned, and Arthur Lawrence said, I'm not saying when, I'm not saying if, I'm saying when you do the show because you are going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they offered me the bus and truck, which I didn't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But then they offered me the last replacement on Broadway. And by that time, I wanted to do it.
Yeah.
I needed a change.
Yeah.
Very excited. So I handed him my notice. And David was very upset. But then he wanted to do, then of course, let's get into La Cage. We'll do quickly that because, you know, of Jerry.
Yeah,
sure.
Of course.
My buddy.
You got reunited. Yeah.
So, and Jerry was so excited. So I go into rehearsal. And of course, 1 week into rehearsal, they posted the notice.
Oh shit.
So I never got on.
Who were you going to play
on? I was with a Broadway company. You know, it was the guy who was the understudy, and I can't think of his name,
okay.
who had it in his contract because he understudied both roles. Whichever role came available, he would do. So they had to take him, and I can't remember his name.
That's brilliant, though.
Yeah. Good agent.
Yeah. yeah. But anyway, but I was with the company.
Man.
I was rehearsed, and
yeah.
they were going to put me on the last week at the Palace,
mm-hmm.
and then we were going to go to the Mark Hellinger.
Right.
And, but... What, because they were building the Embassy Hotel. That's why they closed. They were going to close the show. Because, you know,
and go to the Hellinger.
Yeah, and we were going to go to the Hellinger. And that was going to be the big deal. I was going to open up at the Hellinger. There was a big publicity.
Beautiful theater.
And they had actually posted my picture on the sides of buses.
Yeah?
Yeah, I was there. I was advertised. But then what happened, the Black Tuesday happened with the stock market. Mm. And then also the backers were starting to investigate because they weren't seeing enough profit. Because a lot of people were running their offices off of the gross. So they closed the show.
Wow.
So, and of course, the Mark Hellinger then was leased to a church,
and I it still is. Yeah.
During that, it was going to cost $200,000 to move the show. The producers were going to pay half, the Nederlanders were going to pay the other half.
Wow!
But it didn't come to happen. But I was with a Broadway company and was considered the last replacement.
Yeah, yeah.
Officially.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing.
Sure.
And of course, I went on to do the show many, many times after that.
Of course.
I did it at Paper Mill.
Great show.
Did a little 10-week, 10th anniversary tour I did. And I played subsequent productions in a lot of places. And I played with G. Barry.
Yeah.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah,
oh,
we did
nice.
A summer tour for, you know, we did, where is it there, Westbury and Valley Forge.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah,
we
yeah,
did
totally.
A summer stock tour. And so, you know, I got to play up. But, and then David wanted to do a black version of 42nd Street. So I was doing La Cage down in Texas. And my agents called, because I'm now with William Morris. And so they called and said, David wants a meeting with you. So I said, well, where's my airline ticket? They said, on your day off. They said, oh, you just get the ticket. They'll reimburse you. So I got the ticket. I flew up for a meeting with David. Now, this is when he's not speaking well.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're having a hard time trying to always understand him. So at the meeting, you know, they have the logo now with a black woman. And the gal who was with Fifth Dimension is supposed to play Dorothy Brock.
Mm-hmm.
And who's the wonderful guy who was with Diana Ross at Lady Sings the Blues?
Billy Dee Williams?
That's it. He was going to be... Mm-hmm. Julian Marsh, Greg Burge was going to do my part.
Oh,
and then we're going to discover a new girl to play Peggy Sawyer.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And so everything was set. But I said at the meeting, I said, David, I understand that because of the London production, because David wasn't paying a lot of the original people of their royalties because he wasn't making enough money in London. But he couldn't close the show because he had a contract with the London producers. But he wasn't paying them, and they weren't going to let him do the black version until he paid their royalties. And
oh,
I said, David, I understand you don't
money.
Have the rights because you haven't paid. Well, he got very mad at the meeting, but I was just being honest. And, of course, they didn't.
You were right.
Yeah, you're
they
right.
didn't, and he couldn't do that. And they told. But what happened, they told him he'd have to close the show in New York for 8 weeks and then reopen it to make it legal because you couldn't fire the actors and put in a new company.
Yeah.
So he closed it, and that's what he was going to do.
Wow.
But then the creators, you know, wouldn't let him do it because he wouldn't pay them. He wouldn't pay the royalties back to them. So that was it.
Wow.
So then he went up and got the black version of OK and did that instead.
Yes, that's right. I always forget about that.
So he thought, well, I'll show you. I'll do my own black show. So that's when he brought in OK.
Oh, my gosh.
But it was supposed to be the black 42nd Street.
Yeah.
And then when I flew back to Texas the next day, they never reimbursed me for my airfare.
Of course they didn't.
Of course not.
Yeah, yeah, I never got
reimbursement.
Of course not.
Of course we get reimbursement.
But anyway, listen, David was David. And during that period, you know, I would be invited to things for him, and I got to see him, and although he couldn't speak, but then he got to a point where he became, you know, dementia set in, and he wasn't operating, and, and then the end came, and that was it.
Between 42nd Street and going into La Cage, there are these two Tony Award broadcasts that you're on, which we love, by the way, 85 and 86, I think.
Yeah. That was because of Alexander Cohen. It was terrific.
Any memories of that?
I did a lot of shows for... Oh, yeah.
They're wonderful shows.
I
love
it. And I also did another thing called The Best of Everything for Alex Cohen.
Were you one of the
night... With all the stars in it.
Yes.
And then we did another thing that was called Parade of Stars.
Oh, yes.
Which was
everyone
who played the palace.
Yes. Oh, yes, that's right.
And I did Pat Rooney Jr.
Oh, my gosh.
If you're Irish, come into the parlor. So I did that number.
Which is on YouTube, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah. And then we did Happy Birthday Hollywood for Alex Cohen, where you know they celebrated the first 100 years of Hollywood, where all the stars were there.
Yeah.
I can tell you a story, another dirty story you can't put on. Save it for the 11 o'clock.
Because
while we were there, I was in the room with all the stars from MGM, all the ladies. I mean, everybody was there, every star in the world. Lana Turner, Esther Williams, June Allison, Debbie Ray, everybody in the world. And I was in that room with all those ladies. And, of course, because I was dear friends with Ruby Keeler, and one of Ruby's best friends was Alice Faye and Dorothy L'Amour. So I'm sitting with them talking, and I'm taking pictures of everybody with my camera.
Yeah,
and Alice Faye, with that deep voice, said, "Sweetheart, why don't you go over there and get Arlene Dahl, Esther Williams, and Lana Turner and take their pictures. They have something very much in common." And I said, "Oh, what's that?" She said, "Fernando Lama says which, of course, made me scream. And it was
a class photo.
Because two of them were married to him, and Lana Turner had a big affair with him. So anyway, that was that night. And that's the night that Is that the one we did with with Ann Miller, Shaking the Blues Away?
Mm.
Oh.
I think that's when we did
with her.
And Ruby Keeler was terrific. She came backstage when I first met her, and I told her the story about, you know, my singing, I Only Have Eyes for You. And I said, I really pictured your face, Miss Keeler, and sang to you. She said, well, I'm here tonight. Sing to me now. So I sang to her backstage, and we became really close friends.
That's special.
So whenever I went to Palm Springs, I saw her. Whenever she came to New York, we always had date night. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We always went out. And one night we went out, and she told me she didn't have any tap shoes anymore. She had donated them all to charities because she had had, you know, major stroke.
Yeah.
And she, you know, the left side was sort of paralyzed. She walked with a cane. But she said, my other side can work. I think it was her right side and it was her left side. She said, I can still, you know. And so I called Capizio and had a pair of tap shoes made for her because they still had her on file.
Oh, how sweet.
So the next time we went out on one of our dates, I said, I got a present for you. And she said, now, don't spend your money on me. I don't need anything. You should be saving your money. I said, no, but you need this. And she saw this tap. Well, she cried and we hugged and kissed.
Gosh.
She went back to Palm Springs. She called me on the phone, Rancho Mirage, but Palm Springs, I always say. But she went back and she had me singing in the background on the cast album. And she put the telephone down and was tapping with her shoes on. Yeah, and her daughter. But anyway, that night when she saw the tap shoes, I said, Ruby, as long as I'm alive, you'll always have your tap shoes. And after she had died, her daughter, Kathy, told me that when we were cleaning out Mom's closet, it was so sweet. She always kept your tap shoes right there in the middle.
That's really special.
And she was a great lady. And she had called me before she died and said how they wanted to operate because she had cancer. And then she said, I don't know what to do. She was very religious, very Catholic. Mm. And I said, well, Ruby, at this point in your life, if they cut you open and, you know, it's maybe you just need to talk to God. And she didn't do anything. And then she died shortly thereafter.
Wow.
But she was a wonderful one with the most gorgeous aqua blue eyes, like turquoise, aqua blue, that incredible color. She was one of the sweetest, dearest women. And I know that everybody who was in No-No Nanette with her were just overwhelmed. She always had her dressing room door open. She was like the mother to all of them.
That's right. That's
everybody who knew Ruby Keeler loved her.
Wow.
She was an incredible woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she told me, you know, the dish on Al Jolson, because Al Jolson couldn't have children. And she wanted children. And he was very jealous and possessive. And she said, I could never go any place. He would always have me followed. And she said it was just too restricting. And she finally said, I can't live my life this way. And they adopted a child because she went, and the child, unfortunately, was challenged.
Mm-hmm.
So, but she took care of him his whole life. He outlived her, by the way.
Wow.
And then she, of course, had a second marriage and had, you know, and she, you know, had a happy life. And the kids, of course, had no idea about her being, you know, this big movie star because she just totally played it all down until No-No Nanette brought her back. It
certainly did.
That's incredible. Yeah,
and then, of course, the stroke, you know, ended all of that. But she never let it stop her, and she would go on cruises. She loved to cruise. She loved to gamble on the boats. She had a terrific life. She never let any of that stop her. And Patricia Neal was another one who had the stroke and went on the cruises with us for the Theater Guild, because I did Theater Guild cruises for 20 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was interesting how all that happened, because all the stars that came along, my God. And the first time I went on the cruise, it was due to Juliet Prowse, actually.
Uh-huh. Oh.
Juliet was on the cruise, and Peter Howard, who was the musical director, and I got a call from Marilyn Langner, who said, you know, I'm Marilyn Langner. I said, well, I know who you are, Marilyn. She said, well, we don't know you. Philip and I, and all of our friends tell us all the time, and all the stars say, you should have Leroy Reams on these cruises. And she said, so Larry Kurt is dead, so you can take his place. I swear to God, that's exactly the way it was said.
Oh,
so Larry Kurt had to die before I got to go on a cruise.
Oh, my God.
So I go on the cruise, and we get out in the middle of the ocean. And so they read my resume, and I performed, and they liked me. And she said, I see here that you're a director, too. I said, yes, I can direct. She said, how would you like to go on our next cruise and be a star and a director? And that way we can free up a cabin that we can sell so that I can have two positions on one. And that's
two for
how I
one.
Became the director. So for 20 years,
that's amazing.
When I was free, when I was working, I couldn't do it. But when I was free, I always did the cruises for
Brilliant.
The Theater Guild. And worked, well, I mean, Zoe Caldwell, Rosemary Harris, Patricia Neal, Helen Hayes.
Come on,
Helen
Hayes. God.
Hello. And good stories on Helen Hayes. When we went out and Helen Hayes saw my show, and she asked if she could come to another show.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they said, Helen never does that. Mm-hmm. You should be so flattered that. So we would talk, you know, and became friendly. And then on one of our cruises with Helen, she hadn't performed. And the reason she stopped performing a lot was because she had allergies to dust in the theaters.
Yes.
And so she couldn't, she was allergic to it, which is interesting of all people to be allergic in a theater.
Yeah, exactly.
Helen Hayes.
The irony.
But anyway, she, two stories on Helen when she said, you know, I feel so guilty I haven't done anything on the cruise. She said, I'll do my Queen Victoria speech from Victoria Regina, you know. She said, but I can't remember it all. I'll write it down. So she wrote it down. And that night we had heavy seas. So they were all very nervous about her getting up. And we had everything set at the podium. And I had her handwritten speech there. And so I said, well, she wants to do it, and I'll take care of her. I'll make sure she gets to the podium. And I said, you know, Helen, you have to be very careful you don't fall tonight because the seas are rocky, and I'll escort you out, and then I'll get you at the podium. You hold on, and we've got the light on, and everything's there. She said, fine, dear. So when I said, ladies and gentlemen, the First Lady of the American Theater, Helen Hayes. I went to get her. She just pushed me aside, walked out, made a bow to the center, the seas are rocking, walked over to the podium, put her hand on, did the speech without even looking at the paper.
Oh, that's
so after the speech, of course, I said, Helen, do you want this back? She said, no, darling, throw that away. I said, do you mind if I have it? And would you autograph it to me? She said, oh, I don't want you to have that. That's in my handwriting. And I said, no, no, Helen, I'll treasure it. She said, as well you should. And she said, and because I respect you, I will autograph it to you. And I didn't want it to get creased, so I stuck it in one of my books. I can't find it.
You don't know?
I cannot find it. I got back and put everything away. I thought, oh, I'll remember that. Yeah. I've forgotten where I put it.
It's in a book somewhere.
It's in a book someplace. Oh, my book that I had, you know, because I always would get tour books on all the places we went. And, you know, and I put it away and I can't find it. I don't know where it is. Can't find it. Anyway. And another thing was during this period, Helen said when we get back, because, you know, there at the hospital she's associated with, that was the wing, the AIDS wing that they named after her.
Mm-hmm.
And she said when we get back on land, she said, would you come down and go with me into the wards? Because those guys would probably love to see you.
Mm.
And that's when, you know, it was all, no one knew how you get it, and it was very scary. And I said, if you go, Helen, I'll go.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down with her, and we walked into the wards, and I can tell you, you're talking about pulling yourself together. You saw all of these beautiful young men in beds looking like cadavers.
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't believe it. I just took my breath away. Yeah. And I sat on the beds and talked with them and, you know, camped up and, you know, all that stuff because most of them are gay men.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget it. But Helen Hayes was there. This little lady, she was gallant. She just walked in and, you know, they named the wing after her.
Wow.
She was an incredible woman. I remember one night we were on deck and the moon was huge. And I said, oh, Helen, look at that moon tonight. And I said, and you look so beautiful. Because, you know, she had never had any facial surgery. And she was this incredible-looking woman with those blue eyes and, you know, that Irish temperament. And she said, oh, thank you. She said, but, you know, if I ever had to do it over again, I would have had something done here. And she was pulling out her eyes. And we laughed so hard. She was an incredible woman.
Oh, my gosh. Awesome.
Anyway, and she told me a very funny story. She said, one night that Maureen Stapleton, she was in Sardis with some lady friends from Pasadena. And she said, we're having, and Maureen was, you know, drinking. And came over to the table and looked at Helen. I said, oh, Helen, God, I love you, Helen. I love you so much. If you were a man, I'd fuck you. She told me that story one night.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUPS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUPS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUPSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Loved it so much.
Classy. Yeah. Always classy.
Always.
Going back a little bit, Beauty and the Beast, was it hard? I mean, you were so lucky because everything you've worked on, you've worked with these amazing, brilliant people where you got to originate so many roles. Yeah. And then Beauty and the Beast, you're pretty much going in and you're replacing. What is that like?
Well, it's similar to I've replaced twice. And it was for Gary Beach both times, which is interesting because
great
you would
Gary
never
Beach.
Think of Gary and me being similar,
funny.
But
yeah.
obviously.
Yeah.
And Beauty and the Beast was obviously a big hit, and it was a paying job, and it was a brilliant show and very well done. And so I thought it would be fun to do, but replacing in two shows, given my choice, I would never replace again.
Uh-huh.
Because when you replace in a show, basically you come in the original people are not there, you're not creating it. All they want you to do is just do what the person did before, and you're plugged in. And it's not a happy experience. It has nothing to do with the show. It's just that's the position you're in. And I know when I was watching the show, I was with a sound man one night in the audience, and a lady came by at intermission, and she said she thought I was the sound man. And she said, "We are really enjoying the show." I said, "Thank you, dear." She said, "It's almost as good as the shows we have in Branson." I'll never forget it.
Oh, I bet they are, honey. I bet they are.
One night when I saw this show, this was when the original guy.
Oh, Terrence Mann.
Terrence Mann, God bless him. Terrific. So Terrence Mann, and I remember when he makes the transition and he becomes the prince at the end, and the kid screaming, "It's Mommy, he's still ugly."
Oh!
Those are my two moments from Beauty and the Beast. I laughed my ass off. And Terry Mann is terrific.
Oh, that's good, though.
When he did Cats, I didn't know Terry. And the kids in the company, of course, when I was in the audience, they pointed me out, obviously. And he came over when they ran over their chairs and rubbed his face and got makeup all over me. So, I mean, it was really funny. He's a great guy.
Talented. So,
yeah, very talented. And, you know, works very hard at really doing theater. And,
yes. Yeah,
and he and his
great
wife
guy.
Have that company and
That's
stuff
right.
there. But anyway, that was, and of course, with during rehearsal, of course, you know, the stage manager saying, "Now on this line, you flip the switch and the gas starts. On this line, you press the button and it lights up and you put your hand down on this line." And it was all so technical. And I'm not rehearsing with actors.
Yeah.
I'm in a room with a stage manager. So I was having a really hard time. And I finally said, you know, I'm never going to learn this because it's so hard without the people here. And I did have one day where some of the understudies came in. But the day I was putting the show, I had never rehearsed with Sarah Uriarte or Jeff McCarthy because they didn't come in because they were busy doing the show. And they didn't want to come in. So I was, you know, so I said, just put me on. The show's been running over a year. And, you know, a lot of kids in the audience. I'll find my way. Just put me on. And I was very good. I said, I'll make mistakes, but at least I'll get up and learn how to push the lever and hit the button and light the thing. And, of course, you know, thinking of that drives you crazy. And, of course, you can't work in it during rehearsal because of the fire laws. And they don't keep it in your dressing room. You have to go out. There has to be a stagehand with you. And it's very complicated. So I thought that night, I'm cool. I'll handle this. I've been on, and it was at the Palace Theater. Again, I love the Palace. I, you know, played that theater four times.
Yeah.
So I'm ready to go up and do my thing. And I thought, I'm going to make mistakes, but I'm cool. I'm not under any pressure. There are no critics out there. And as I'm going up the step, when the kid said, "Holy Roy, that's an exciting. Barbara Streisand's in the audience tonight." So, of course, I'm coming down on the staircase and I look down there. She is like the sixth row on the aisle. You couldn't miss her. I don't know what I did that night. I really don't. I know I came off once. I said, "Leroy, you're on, you're on." I tried to go back on stage and they grabbed me. They said, "No, your hands." I was still lit. I didn't turn off the fire. Oh, I was tell you.
Literally.
And of course, that night I looked at myself in the mirror and I said, "Leroy, you're 52 years old and you have a fucking candle on your head." Who knew?
Who knew?
At this point. So it was not one of my, creative moments doing that show, but I eventually found my way. And of course, the director, who was not there at all,
no.
And when he came to see the show, said, "Well, I I just have written down here, sexy, 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 sexy. Be more sexy. I said, isn't that interesting? Because your stage manager, one day I did something, said, Leroy, you can't do that. This is a Disney show. I said, so you need to talk to your stage manager if you want to be sexy, sexy, sexy. I said, so, you know, you need to get with your stage manager and teach him what you want to have happen because you've never been here. Amazing. You know, and eventually I found my way and I made some good friends.
Of course.
Good
Jeff
for
McCarthy
you. Was terrific. Sarah, I adored. Stacey Logan, you know, Mark Kudish.
Yes.
Oh, we all God, became, yeah. you know, good friends. I love the actors. Yeah. And the show was meticulously kept. It was
Disney.
Oh, my oh, yeah. God. Disney. It was just you. And of course, Eisner came to see the show and was very unhappy that I didn't, that I wasn't Gary Beach and didn't think that my French accent was, you know. So they had me go to someone at Juilliard.
Oh.
So, and I was very angry, but I went. And I went in and I read, and she said, I don't know why you're here. You have a beautiful French accent. I said, I know. What they want me to do was sound like Maurice Chevalier.
Right.
And do all that, which I refuse to do. It's my character. So she said, well, I don't know what to say. I said, just say what you said. Write it down. And she wrote down, blah, 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 that Leroy Reams has a legitimate, beautiful French accent.
Got your note from your teacher.
I took it back and I said, here, give this to Michael Eisner and tell him to shove it up his ass. That if he wants a French accent, that's what I do. If he wants someone to do a cheap Maurice Chevalier impression, then have him hire an actor who does that.
Brilliant.
So obviously I was only there for a year. And that was the end of my Disney experience.
Hey, that's done. We all have had one of those.
And then off to what the producers?
Yeah. And the producers, it was the, you know, the national tour.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't quite prepared for the first day of rehearsal because I had just finished doing Peter Pan down at the Muni playing Captain Hook. And I can't do two things at once. I can't do a show at night and then memorize things in the day.
Yeah.
My mind is not... I'm not that good. So I decided not to face that until I went into rehearsal. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't prepared because when I got in, Lewis and Don Stevenson had already been ready caught up. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people were off book. And Angie Schwer, of course, had done it. And so, you know, everybody, and I was the one that was reading the script.
Right.
So I was at a disadvantage, and it was hard.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again... The stage manager, Susan was there most of the time, but not really. Right. It was the stage manager putting you in. So it put you at a
essentially
great disadvantage.
Stage blocking it.
And I had my own way of, you know.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget Steve Zweigbaum, who was the stage manager, said, now, Leroy, when you make your entrance, you know, you're very insecure about how you look because, you know, Carmen made the dress and you love. I said, I don't believe any of that shit. This is Roger Debris. He's rich. His family got him out of town because he's this big fairy, and he hires all these people that live with him that he pays for everything. They tell him he's gorgeous every day. That's just his way of getting attention. And he comes on to all these men because he thinks he's gorgeous. And he sees Leo, and he thinks Leo is going to love him, and he's vamping him and all of this because that's what he does. That's what makes it funny. That's why Leo responds the way that this man comes out dressed up as a woman.
Yeah.
And I said, so that's not it at all. He just plays, you know, being petulant. You know, that's what he does. And I don't think that at all. So I had a really hard time.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, eventually... When they left me alone, I found it when we were out of town, as we all did.
Yes.
But every actor was having the same problem I was because they were wanting us to do what the person who did it before. And they were very strict on everything. I know that we did a little thing in the Hitler number where everything was tanks were coming on, parachutes were coming in, and they were worried about me going, World War II. And looking for a war, here's World War II. And they came over and the guy said, Leroy, we can't really see you going, World War II.
With your fingers.
I said, because it's very fast. I go, World War II. You couldn't tell what I was. I said, so I'll work on it that night. Of course, I went out and I said, if you're looking for a Jew, here's World War II. Because I was thinking about my hand. So, you know, I'm famous for doing shit like that. But anyway, we eventually found it. And of course, then when I did this show with Marty Short and Jason Alexander.
Yes.
And Marty is too creative to do anything the same way twice. So he goes out every night ready to party. And I'm ready for that. I'm ready there to play with him. I can improvise. And I liked him. And so I could make my tits come out of my dress if I would pull in my stomach. Mm-mm. And I can make it so. And Marty would get bored in the scenes if he didn't have a lot to do. So whenever you get bored, I just shoot him, you know, my tits. So you know, I got a lot of notes on that. But I said, well, you know what it is? That's funny because a man in a dress is funny. So if you see hairy legs, that's funny. If you see a hairy chest, that's funny. That he's a man in a woman's dress. Yes. That's what makes it so ridiculous. And Mel Brooks agreed, by the way. Oh, yeah. By the way. But, you know, that's not the way it was done originally.
Totally.
So you go through all that crap. Well, the night that I showed my tits and, you know, Marty loved it. And I got the notes because there was always a person who took notes and gave you cards. And that was Susan's way of doing it. So I took the cards. I said, okay, guys, you like to play? Here's the note I got. And they went up to the stage and they said, this is our show. And he's funny and we like what he does. And that's it. So no more notes.
Wow.
And
nice.
They had a hard time in L.A. Because Marty I believe and Jason.
That. They want to play.
They got very strong. They said, this is our show now. And if you don't like what we do, fire us. Mm-hmm. But we're going to do our show. And that's not always the way when you replace.
No, it's more about hitting the marks that the person behind you
hit. That's right. Yeah.
And speaking of a man in a dress, you were the first man to play Dolly Levi. Is that correct?
Yes.
How did this come about?
Well, after having, I'll tell you, working in Lacage and putting in all that stuff, I mean, it sounded like great fun at the beginning, but then when you face the reality and all you put all that stuff in, I remember the first night when I was ready to go on and I had on the tits and the corset and the tights and then the pantyhose over that and the robe and all that shit on, plus all the makeup and stuff. I thought, I feel like a center for the Green Bay Packers. I've got so much stuff on and the high heels and all of that. But you adjust to it, but it's a lot of stuff you got to get into. And not that I want to dress up as a woman. It's not that at all. It's the part.
Yeah.
It's playing a good part, and I love Hello, Dolly.
Oh, yeah.
And that character is so great. And Carol is a comic genius, and it will always be Carol Channing. She's the originator, but being so close to the show and loving it so much, I wanted the experience of playing that character.
Yeah.
And I can't play Cornelius anymore, so I really wanted the experience of doing that. And then open the door, because I think actors, it's fun to see people play sexes.
Yeah.
You know,
why not?
The importance of being earnest and all
that.
Yes. It's famous that, you know, and women should be able to dress up like men. If a woman wants to play Professor Higgins, then let her do it.
Totally.
It's fun for the audience. And in Shakespeare's day, it was only men anyway. Yeah. They played all the women's roles. So it's just opening the door and relaxing people and having the pleasure of doing it and having fun for the audience. That's why I wanted to do it.
It
was a great experience. And, and Lewis Stadlin is one of my buddies.
Yeah.
And we had a blast playing the show every night, doing those scenes together.
Oh, yeah.
And the audience had a good time with us. And I never thought of, I would never play it with a wink in my eye, like, hey, I'm a man dressed up as a woman and doing it. I played the part. I got dressed up and I was Dolly Levi. And those speeches were so wonderful to do. I got tears in my eyes every night because the piece is so good. And I, you know, loved Jerry, and it was a privilege to do his material. And Mike Stewart, who wrote a brilliant book.
Totally.
And to be able to, those were my buddies and my friends, and I wanted to honor them and give the way the show was originally conceived and done with Gower's original direction.
Yep.
Did Jerry get to see it?
No. No, he didn't. He didn't come up to see it.
And he was okay. I mean, obviously, he must have approved.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because he knew I was going to be honest.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to, you know, play it as a takeoff or
no.
You know.
Did you direct it as well as?
Yeah.
How
it was
do you
easier.
Really?
Yeah, it was easier because I knew it so well. The only problem was during the tech.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't be out to watch, but Norb Jurder came down to help out technically, and Randy Slavagico choreographed.
Good.
They were out front so they could watch things. I wish I could be both places, but I couldn't.
So of course.
I had to concentrate on what I was doing.
Ah, do you hope to do it again sometime?
I would, but I don't know whether anyone would be brave enough to you know, do it again.
Well, you can always replace Bette Midler next year.
I would love to be her standby.
Yeah, amen.
Because I think it would take a man to stand by for Bette Midler.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I mean, listen, are you kidding? I'd love it. As a matter of fact, we did the last tour that I directed, and when I played Cornelius, I thought about being Carol's standby. on that 3-month tour, but I didn't want to go to rehearsal. I wanted to. That's true. And number two, you'll never go on because Carol's never out.
No.
So, and then Monica Wimmett, who was the played Ernestina, was a lovely, lovely gal. I thought, let her do it because she'll learn and she'll get a chance to play it someday, which later. She has.
That's great.
And I loved her. Yeah. And then, of course, my God, Carol got sick. Missed a whole weekend. And I thought about going on and I couldn't do it to Monica. So I let Monica go on. That was my chance to have done it. Because what a great gimmick to walk on and say, ladies and gentlemen, Carol Channing never misses a show.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, she's sick. She does not have an understudy. I'm the director, and I'm going to have to do the show tonight. So if
I love
just,
it.
You know, and then do it.
Would have been great.
I mean, it would have been a great gimmick, right?
Would have been hysterical.
Totally.
But not to be.
Oh, man.
Well,
that would work for Bette Midler, too, by the way.
Yeah, right?
You know.
Get Jerry's axe. Jerry's axe.
That's right. Yeah.
Don, honey, listen, they're all too. When people do it, they want to do it their way, and that's the way it is.
Truth.
You can't tell anybody what to do. And they,
I hope
if they want
to
Dolly
it.
To come out in a purple dress, she'll come out in a purple dress. Yeah. I want mine to be red. But, you know, that's the way people are. They want to change it. And now, if Jerry has anything to say so in it, it will be. But, you know, again, when they did the film, she was in gold.
Oh, yeah.
We just watched it the other day, actually. Confession.
Streisand is the greatest talent of my generation.
Yeah.
It's impossible for her to ever be bad.
It's true.
It just wasn't good casting.
Yeah.
No,
she made it work for what she does, but it wasn't the Hello Dolly I know. And also, with the exception of, you know, a couple people, the rest of it wasn't that well cast either.
Yeah.
No.
And, you know, they dubbed the gal playing Irene Malloy.
That's right.
So why? And, you know, I had never heard of her before or since. So, you know, Anne Margaret tested for it originally, you know.
She would have been great.
Yeah. Well, not my idea, but, you know, there are certainly a lot of women capable of doing it.
Of Irene Malloy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, and Michael Crawford as Cornelius was, I don't know what that was.
It is an awkward film.
I don't know what.
From start to finish.
Moments, and then also, but yes. A lot of Michael Kidd's choreography, I mean, people were rolling around on concrete sidewalks doing somersaults and rolling down hills in the grass. What does that mean? You're in, you know, and you're in Victorian dress and you're rolling down the hill on the grass? What
is
that?
Oh my gosh.
And that thing, you know, the waiters gallop with all the acrobatics and the gimmicks, and you go, oh my God.
It's a showpiece, that's
just,
for sure.
It is something.
Before we go, I want to just ask you really quickly about, you've got a show you do, a one-man show.
Yeah.
Probably a couple. Yeah. Do you have any plans in the future? Anywhere we can see it coming up?
Well, if you want to come down to the Crest Theater.
Hey!
In Delray Beach.
Do you do mostly Jerry Herman in your act?
No. I do some Jerry Herman, yeah, but I talk about Julia Prowse, my beginnings. And
great.
And then I go and I do, you know, Dolly.
Yeah.
And I do a little bit of 42nd Street. Mm. I don't do all the shows.
Right.
But I do, you know, the major things that are more identifiable for the audience.
Well, I want to see it.
Yeah. Me too.
I do.
I want to see
it. And
that.
A lot of the stories I've told you, I you know, go into my act.
I love that.
Turn on the lights. I'll do it no matter where I am.
Yeah. That's showbiz.
It's a wonderful line of applause. It says, stand back. At 8 o'clock, I do the show no matter where I am. Because it's true.
And that's...
You get so... And because I did the Broadway for so long, around 5 o'clock, I still get that.
Yep.
Time to get ready to do the show. I still have that feeling.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
I never lose that. And there was never a time, seriously, and I mean this honestly, with all the shows I've done, there has never been a time where I go, I am so tired today. How am I going to get through this show? Mm. Oh, my God, this is so boring. I'm doing the same thing. Because people said to me, how could you do 42nd Street? 8 shows a week for almost 8 years? How could you do that? Well, because the audience is different every night. And
that's
also,
right.
There's a pride about being a Broadway actor. And I've never, ever not walked into a Broadway theater with that feeling of energy and excitement and just can't wait to get on the stage. I cannot be anywhere in a high school and I walk out on a stage, I have that feeling.
Yep.
It's being in the amphitheaters of Europe, standing on a stage and looking out, it's that feeling.
Yeah.
It's where I belong.
Yeah.
It's where I'm at home and where I'm most comfortable. I can't explain it to you, but it's been that way my entire life. Yeah. You just, that's what I do.
Yeah.
And I did one film with, you know, Fosse doing a Sweet Charity. That was a trip. But that's all technical.
Yeah.
You have to, it's all for the camera and you set up. And it's also so time consuming that you have to stop in between and then get your energy up to do it. You're not in control. Where in the theater, the curtain goes up and it's yours.
And there's no stopping.
Like, and nobody can cut you or say no and make you do it again. You're in control. That's why actors love the live theater. Nothing better than that. The movies and television can't do it. I did a lot of television, and a lot of television was live, but you basically are there performing for the camera. It's a whole different thing. It's a privilege and an honor to do in life what you do naturally, and it pays you money. I think that's the secret of having a good life, finding something you enjoy doing, having not a job, but a career.
And you still worked your butt off to get there.
Yeah, and I'm limited now because of my age, and we have to grow into what we do. But, you know, ever given the chance, I'm ready to do whatever is required just to be a part of it.
I love
and
that.
Also the people, the creative people that you get to work with and watching all this talent. And, you know, it's like anything in life. It has its ups and its downs, but as far as I'm concerned, it's mostly been ups.
I like that.
And to have also worked with people you dreamed about working with when you sat in your living room with your, you know, your show albums, listening to the music and saying, oh, God, if only I could be on Broadway one day. And, you know, my first Broadway show that I saw was Carnival, and I ended up working with Jerry Orbach.
Oh, see?
Turned out to be a terrific guy.
Dreams do come true.
To have that in your life, to been a kid in high school and watching Carol Channing throw out a bracelet, and then years later you're working with her, being, you know, one of Lauren Bacall's best friends. I mean, you, that's what you live for in your life. I feel frustrated in the fact that what I did was sort of out of fashion, because I should have been born in the MGM period.
Well, that's true.
That would have been my period. I would have been at MGM singing and dancing in the movies. That would have been it, but I was born too late.
Yeah.
But at least during the time I did get a chance to do it. I mean, you go through the list of these people, my God. And I was there with them, Gower Champion, Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
That you're there working with those people. And it's funny that you don't think of them as being real people because they're so iconic until you work with them.
Right.
And then suddenly you have to realize they're real like the rest
That's
of
right.
us. But I've never lost that reverence. Or the love of it, and the great respect for the people who do it. And I wish that there was some way I could continue. And I don't think that I was ever used to my fullest potential during my career. I got used to a degree. And 42nd Street, obviously, the singing and the dancing, but and the actor I got to do with Lacage and Dolly and things like that, but never at the beginning or created and done. But at least I've had the experience of doing it.
Oh, yeah.
And, but then you have to think that maybe it's not over till the fat ladies sing. Maybe that thing that's going to use me to the fullest is yet to be done. So you just hope that it could come.
Yeah.
And someday they're going to ring the phone and
that's
you're
right
for something that's going to finally take advantage of what you can give back.
Join us next week where we interview Rodgers and Hammerstein Organization's Ted Chapin.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.